Welcome back to today's WISCAPE Forum on Funding and Accountability in Public Higher Education. As I said earlier, I'm Noel Berdomsky, the director of WISCAPE. To continue the dialogue began by Professor Trostel, it's my pleasure to introduce Edward St. John. Professor St. John is Algo D. Henderson Collegiate Professor of Education at the University of Michigan Center for the Study of Higher Education, Higher and Postsecondary Education. A prolific researcher, Professor St. John has completed 25 books and more than 200 articles, book chapters, reviews, and policy studies. His books on public financing of higher education include Refinancing the College Dream, Access, Equal Opportunity, and Justice for Taxpayers, Public Financing of Higher Education, New Context, New Rationales, and Privatization in Public Universities. His most recent book is Education in the Public Interest, School Reform, Public Finance, and Access to College. He serves as series editor for Readings on Equal Education and has received national awards for leadership and research. Dr. St. John received his EdD from Harvard Graduate School of Education, an MEd and BS from the University of California, Davis. His presentation today is entitled Funding Higher Education Wisely, Implications for the Wisconsin Idea. And one brief note, we will have the MP3 files of each of the presentations up on the web next week. Also, if you haven't not yet signed up, we can send you the PowerPoints, etc., if you provide your name and your email address on the table on the sheet in the hallway. So with that, please welcome Ed St. John. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And I realized over the weekend when I was putting this together that there was sort of an oxymoron in the title. Can anybody recognize it? Funding Higher Education Wisely. Which is to say that doing that's really tough. It's, you know, we got military intelligence and we have other terminology that we think of. And I think that the conversation from the last presentation illustrates the problem. And as we shift to more of a market world of higher education, the old constructs sometimes are difficult to communicate given a legislative mind that values the marketplace. And so some of the questions got into that. My talk today is a little different. It's based on applied research. A lot of my research is done in collaboration with government agencies or interest groups. My goals are to do research that meets a rigorous standard of publication as well as that informs policy development. I'll speak a little bit about the Indiana context for that as I move through. But today, my talk will draw from two areas of research, and I'm not going to go into great detail about the research, but rather talk about the implications. One is work I do with state indicators. Those indicators relate both to finance and education policies as they relate to access and other outcomes. And the other is work in Indiana, and I'll speak to the Indiana case some. I have a book in review with SUNY Press tracking the 2000 cohort in Indiana from high school through college. So I will be speaking to that, some of that work, which is currently being done and written about also for Lumina Foundation. So I'm not going to give you a lot of numbers and tables on that. I'll be happy to share reports, and they will be shared as they come along. So what I want to do is just talk a little bit about the policy context for the covenant, share some of my critical thoughts about financial readiness, inequality, and a variety of things related to preparation and so forth, and present Indiana's case study consider briefly with you the implications for the covenant. Do you still call it the covenant, or is it called the idea? I heard the covenant. All right, the covenant. So I'll just move ahead with this. Okay, federal context. We've had some gushing around two things that are pretty well known, and then later we'll get more to the accountability side of this. But we've been moving from grants to loan as a primary federal student aid policy, and that's pretty well known and documented. There's a case to be made about it undermining access for low-income students, and I'll speak more to that. And we have a new regime. Well, it's an old regime now since starting really, in one sense, the precursors to it were the Education Consolidation Act of 1980, kind of a Carter initiative, but certainly since 83, an accountability approach. So we need to think about policy relative to that. But another way to think about our policy context are in terms of the big shifts. Some years ago, Jay and Lee gave a paper about a shift, and they've talked about it as a shift from equity to quality. I don't know if you have questions or would raise the quality question, but certainly what's been emphasized are policies that promote education for all. And it did come about around the time of the formation of the Department of Education. The Department of Education had to rationalize itself in a way that could enable it to come out of HEW and stand alone as an agency. That rationale shifted the focus from the court-mandated and other issues that got the federal government into equity-based policies originally into programs trying to kind of equalize opportunity for all. And in the process, a set of middle-income programs have been developed. So, and I'll talk more about that, but I think that's very important to us. Now, the issue of rights was raised, and I think we do need to think about rights in education. We have a legal context for thinking about rights in K-12. We have school funding cases and so forth. We don't have that in higher education because, unlike K-12, where there's constitutional bases for state litigation, we don't have that in higher education because of the role of choice. And everybody is not thought to have the right to get a higher education. However, as I think about the issue relative to at least the rationale being used to ratchet up access, an argument is being made that essentially is something like the following, that some college at least is needed to earn a living, enough money to support your family. The last Double the Numbers conference last Friday had hordes in Washington to talk about that very issue. The National Governors Association and other groups have kind of developed a literature for states telling them that the way to get there is through improving high school preparation and so forth. And so, in fact, our higher ed commission in the state of Michigan, the Cherry Commission, stayed away from higher ed finance and recommended a new high school curriculum. So higher ed planning has become high school curriculum planning, at least in Michigan. And fortunately, in other states, we do more than that in Indiana's case. But as we think about these issues in terms of, and I think claiming that higher ed's a right is really pushing the envelope, but it's just interesting to ponder relative to the economic argument, the $481,000 on the ground. If everybody had a higher ed, the differential wouldn't be $481,000, as I'm sure Lee would tell us, but and others in the room. But the fact is that there are thresholds of education. The overeducated American was referenced earlier. The shift in the screening device happened unforeseen from high school to college, you know, in terms of good jobs and so forth. And so it's a complicated context in which we try to come up with ratios and so forth. What I'm concentrating on today is state variabilities. We have variabilities in funding for need-based and merit grants in states. We have variability in state graduation policies. You know, I'll get into some of the details of this, but the fact is those variabilities in policies relate in some way to variabilities in outcomes in high school graduation rates, in college going rates, and I would argue also in degree production rates, but I haven't gotten there yet in the indicators work. If any of you want to write Lumina Foundation to fund the next round, then that'd be great. I'm sorry, that's bad. So I will be speaking about these things. Now, there are really a couple of models for the Wisconsin Covenant. I'll speak mostly about the Indiana 21st Century Scholars Program. It's a case I've worked on quite a bit. And it is a design model to think about. The North Carolina Covenant is important because the language has been adopted from the Covenant. The difference between the Covenant in North Carolina and the 21st Century Scholars is that the state context difference, which I get into. North Carolina now is very high on need-based aid relative to other states. So it didn't cost the university a dollar to make the commitment to in-state residents. And that, so the University of Michigan, following it an impact, it cost us many millions of dollars. We had to sell property, we had to go to donors just to keep up with North Carolina. So the difference in state context is critical. And that is where the battle is in Wisconsin, excuse me, with respect to student aid. I'll get into this. So there's a bottom line in Wisconsin. There's, and the rhetoric so far that I've seen, and I haven't seen it all with respect to the covenant, is it's trying to kind of put together a rationale. We did this in Indiana too, that appeals to academic preparation, merit aid, need-based aid. You know, you build arguments in policy. But coherence of the program is very important, so I'll come back to that later today as well. Now, I think that one thing you need to keep in mind, in the 2000s, Wisconsin is doing as well as or better than the national average on some indicators. And I'm going to speak to that, and that's important to know, because where you stand relative to states is very important in terms of thinking about how you craft policy. But I alluded to this, Wisconsin context of low funding for state grants will make it very hard to fulfill the covenant, much as it would be hard to do in Michigan. New York wouldn't be hard. So, or California wouldn't be hard. And Washington hasn't passed a bill to do the same thing, so they'll have to have some ground to catch up. But so different states are following or looking at this kind of model. So I think the focus on academic preparation, that is to say that, did I go two slides or? Where am I? Okay. Is very important as a part of a strategy. And maybe the idea of funding education wisely, we need to not just think of funding education as being financial. We need to think of it as also being educational. And given that we're in a transition with respect to preparation and access, it may be especially important that we think about that. And I will even say some things later on about what we're doing in Michigan in this regard. Now, as I go through my critical thoughts, I'm going to say a few things about the diverse realities, talk about some trends. There's some trends that were different in the 80s and 90s than what we've seen in the 2000s. In the 80s and 90s, we saw a decrease in high school graduation rates, an increase in college going rates, and a race-ethnic gap. I'll go through that real quickly. We also do know that there's a link between state funding for need-based grants and college enrollment rates. It's well established. There's also a link between funding for merit grants and college enrollment rates, although there's a discouragement factor with merit grants and high school completion rates. Georgia was in 2000 down to 50% high school graduation. And it appears to be that kids under the margin of the merit have look at other economic realities. But we see, when we do those kind of models, we put state funding in the 10th grade year and look at the effects. We were testing the Bishop hypothesis, and it turned out the reverse of Bishop's assumption. But so we've had some changes, improvement in a reversal of the trend, improvement in high school graduation rates nationally, slight, but nevertheless a reversal of the trend in the 2000s. And college enrollment rates during this period, with all the NGA attention on preparation, are actually going down a little bit as well. Now, one thing that's very important is that we have a rhetoric, a language with respect to financial aid, federal financial aid, that it's need-based. Okay? And but we have another reality. The other reality is the following. The way the Pell formula works and the Pell maximum is that there's a huge gap for low-income students. I'll illustrate that later. But the presence of subsidized loans and the current state of the Pell maximum is pretty good for middle-income families. So with the Middle-Income Student Assistance Act, we really did create a good middle-income program, and we have never been able to fund Pell at the levels mandated before MISA, if we'd have kind of even kept those going with inflation, or linked them to what tuition was. So that's a really complicated situation. So what we have is that we know wealthy families can do what they want, and they have academic capital, and they encourage preparation. The current encouragement policies in many states assume that aid exists, and federal aid does exist for the middle income, and so we have an ethos of encouragement that's being promoted by ACE and other groups that sort of is really great middle income policy. But we still have a serious low income policy in the country problem. Now, this isn't well, it doesn't come across too well, too badly. This shows the enrollment rates by race ethnic group between 70, 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 2000, and just goes up to 2001. I need to update it. But the point I want to say here is whichever year you take in the 70s, one of the three groups is higher than the other. Some years in the 70s, African-American high school graduates went to college at higher rates than whites. And some years lower, Hispanics the same. Because what we had, those were the years when Pell had been implemented. We didn't have an overall increase in enrollment rates. And Lee, you pointed that out. But we did have some kind of funny things going on in terms of equalizing that we didn't perhaps pay enough attention to, because as we've got into our middle class aid period, we see big gaps. And we it's hard to get the income stuff from NCE, from the CPS kind of data. So I don't show this in terms of income. Some people are trying to do that work, and it's less dramatic with respect to income in some ways, but there's still differentials. So earlier I made the argument that it was linked somehow to Pell. This illustrates the situation. What we have above the line is the Pell maximum, the total cost of attendance, the differential between the two. There was a 50% cost provision originally in Pell, but tuition was low. The max went over the cost period of time. So it was a choice program as well. But what we see happening since we've done away with the max is a gap for the zero EFC family, the family that can't contribute a dollar, can get the maximum Pell and pay the average cost. We see that there's quite a differential that needs to be made up with what we might call a work loan burden, if there's not a great state grant program. And that's where the variability in state grants comes in ways that make it very interesting with respect to both college enrollment rates and diversity. Now, this is a table I updated. Well, this is actually drawing from Mortensen's data. I use his work on graduation rates and college enrollment rates, continuation rates. And I've gone about the task of recalculating them once, but I realize he does some good data cleaning. So Tom's indicators are probably as clean as we can get them without a better reporting scheme. But this just looks between 2000 and 2004. And I'm sorry that Michigan's in red, because we all know that red is Wisconsin, right? Okay. Sorry. But Wisconsin, see what I was saying earlier? You know, nationally, we've actually improved a little bit on high school graduation rates recently. I think that's important to know. Wisconsin's followed this national average. Michigan had a big increase. It probably will look differently when the new graduation requirements come into play, unless we do a whole lot of things in the state, but that's another show I'll get into. So, you know, Midwest is making gains and so forth. Now, this is another table a figure I find really interesting. This is the college continuation rates. It's the ratio of in-state freshmen to high school graduates. Again, it's one of Tom's figures. And it shows big gains in New York in this four-year period. Minnesota, a little bit of gain, about zero, but some gain in Wisconsin, and a decline nationally in other states in the region. So what that means is, except for three states in the region, we have real gains in high school graduates and decline in the percent going to college. So at the very least, we know that there are more high school graduates not going to college in most Midwestern states, or most of the Great Lakes states. Now, it's hard to see this. I apologize. This shows a set of policies that are moving toward implementation. As an example, the first one is states have established math standards. It was 7 in 1990 and 50 in 2000. But we see the number of math courses required for graduation. States with 3 or more going up from 21 to 28 by 2005. We see the high school having an honors diploma option going up from 19 to 22 between 2000 and 2005. From 19 to 22. And this is exit exams are going back up again. So we see a set of policies going into place that are really aimed at improving preparation at the same time that we see more kids graduating, which is really interesting. So the NGA, MATRA, somebody may be listening, who knows. But the other thing to look at is that There was also a national gain in the SAT from 1019 to 1028, and an especially large gain in math from 514 to 520 nationally. So we're graduating more high school students, they're getting more rigorous curriculum, and they're better prepared by our conventional measure, but they're going to college at a lower rate. Pretty interesting. Now, here's another factor. The blue states here aren't, this is not red and blue, you know, it's white and blue. So, but the blue states here are the states that have not just required more courses, but increased the level of course requirement, but in this period for graduation. It was actually implemented. So New York is the one in the area, the states I'm looking at in this region. A lot of other states have been doing this, but New York, remember, was the outlier on a number of the indicators, so something interesting is going on in New York. Michigan and Indiana have new high school graduation requirements coming into play. Oh, Indiana and Michigan, I remember my old home state is. At least Algebra 2 in those states, in about 210 to 212, those policies will be going into play. So that's very interesting in terms of what's going on. So. Now, here's another, I've done a number of analyses that other people have of need-based grants. Since we have the variability in states, we can really see it with state funding. This is simply plotting two lines. The top line is the continuation rate, the percentage of high school graduates going on to college using the ratio of the number of graduates to the residents going on to college in a state. Crude indicator. But it improved in the 92 to 96 period, dropped slightly. This is an interesting ratio. This is the ratio of your weighted average public tuition charge to the average state funding for need-based aid. Okay? And it's curves a little bit like this other line. So need-based funding for aid has gone down relative to tuition. Not necessarily gone down. But we had a period in which the state aid was kind of holding its own with tuition, and in this decade, it's gone down. And we see that the same number that comes out in the time series state models that we run and so forth. Now, what I think that's very important to think about is this variability in the ratio I just showed. This is the ratio of state funding per FTE of state grant to the weighted average state tuition charge. Nationally, it's 11%. In the old days, we used to talk about Minnesota and Illinois and at times even Pennsylvania as being good models. They fall into the average. The last dollar method in Minnesota is a problem if you don't raise your max on the grant award. Those of you that follow student aid might. But the states that are very high are Indiana and New York. Now, this is important because in Michigan, the true Badger state, no, that's the red state here. In Michigan, we would have to go a long way to provide kind of a guarantee like Indiana's doing. And you're going to have to do the same thing in Wisconsin. To get serious, you got a road to travel. They could do the covenant in North Carolina because they were already up in that region. And what is that region? I would, you know, going back to the rights issue, I think that we can talk about fairness and so forth, and you know, there's no good metrics for this stuff, but if we want to think about optimizing, and we never do that in higher ed funding, but if we wanted to think about it, a one-quarter ratio would be a good ratio. And why? Well, at that ratio, the person right at the median wouldn't get a state grant, and the lowest income person would get a grant covering tuition, and it would have a need-based scale, and in addition, the middle-income kid could take advantage of that great federal middle-class aid system. And other students would get a supplement to pay for housing and other costs, and you'd, if federal aid didn't change, we'd have a fairly good setup. So, you know, I've been using this as a fairness kind of indicator, and it's for what it's worth. Nobody optimizes, and it's all, every single budget item is politically constructed, so nobody thinks about these ratios. But it's fun to babble about it. So some general observations. There's high school curriculum reforms going on. It's It's underway most states. There's not much in the way of evaluation of these policies. We don't know as much as we should about which policies are working or not, which ones are linked to high school dropout, which ones are linked to graduation, and which ones are linked to improving SAT scores and so forth. We don't know enough about that, but we have a laboratory to find out more about that. We know that, I put this something up here, Michigan, we've been working a lot on partnerships. Why have we been doing that? In Michigan, we're a state of savage inequalities in high schools. To deal with Proposition 2, and the University of Michigan announced this last Thursday at a meeting, we're starting a new outreach and academic achievement center that will work with high school districts that are underrepresented districts that is aimed at coming in and supplementing the work underway to implement the new curriculum. So as an example, we're working with King High School in Detroit. We've been there 2 years. If they're moving to Algebra 2, we're coming with pre-calc, and we're using the university's pre-calc supplemental instruction system. We're educating the teachers on how to teach and grade. And so we're going at the problem directly as it relates to trying to enable more Michigan students from high schools that have had these inequalities to prepare for college. They probably won't all be eligible for the University of Michigan, but Michigan needs the pool of students. We don't have it. We have such extreme, we're one of the most extreme states in the country with respect to white schools and black schools. Gary Orfield has shown that many times. And so we have to do something, and we're doing it in urban and rural districts, and that's part of our intention as a university. Your state, your situation may be different, but we're extremely poor with respect to state grants, so our institutional state grant program is costing us a fortune. And we are now taking, we have a revenue-based model. We take tuition off the top and so the academic units don't complain about being taxed. I used to argue against doing that, and because I thought the state had the obligation to equalize. I still do, but what do you do if you're trapped with respect to race-blind admissions about 50 years before the court said we needed to be absolutely blind, and you're in a state of savage inequalities? Well, you have to become more assertive with respect to a reconception of fairness. Fairness related to preparation, admissions that are fair and just, and so on and so forth. So I think that these issues of state financing of higher education are very important. I think we need to ensure access for prepared students to some kind of four-year college, because right now we know in the 2000s we're leaving kids behind. I think we need to ensure quality education. I think we need to make sure that the revenues are sufficient for quality education. The old Minnesota model, where they ran the revenue basis for the University of Minnesota and other campuses and compared it to peer institutions, and then did their percentage of state funding in that model, probably worked pretty well. And so most states leave out the revenue that's needed for quality education. And I think if we're giving access to poor quality education, we're giving some false promise. Optimizing the use of tax dollars, I explained my 25% notion in its theory. And it's not practice. And the guarantees can work if those sort of conditions are met. Now I'm going to jump into the Indiana study, and I'll try to go through this quickly. One thing to say, in Indiana, our Indiana Education Policy Center got started in the 80s. We worked with the legislature doing research to redesign the state finance system. That included funding for schools as they offered more preparatory curriculum that really incentivized change in the state. We did a whole set of things, but we had a very engaged form of scholarship with the state. And it wasn't identified as Indiana University, it was identified as the Policy Center. During the same time, we had an organization called ICPAC that was doing studies, and that is what led to a kind of a great preparatory system. So those are things we all took advantage of as we kind of moved into implementing the Scholars Program. And we've been doing, with the support of Lumina Foundation, a series of studies of that. And I'll be speaking to that. Now, you saw in an earlier slide that Indiana has declined in college enrollment rates in the 2000s. But it's important to note that it's done better than the national average, both with respect to college enrollment rates and high school graduation rates. And in fact, it's gone from like 45th to 9th in college enrollment rates. And now that's not all attributable to 21st century scholars, because there's a comprehensive set of things going on, these high school reforms. What they did was require every high school to offer the curriculum. They didn't require the curriculum for about a decade, but they provided extra funding to schools for every graduate with the curriculum on top of the core funding. There was access to preparation. There was alignment with admissions. The guarantee in 21st Century Scholar eased the concerns, and there was extensive encouragement and information to all students, and so on and so forth. So this is the logical model I use to do the research and communicate about it and so forth. I know it's hard to read, but here we have the K-12 policies, a solid line indicating alignment. Here we have the guarantee. It all starts with a guarantee for low-income students. We're finding lots of ways that the guarantee is an encouragement or enabling students to engage in a more difficult preparatory curriculum. I'll speak to that just a little bit. So the preparatory curriculum option, the honors diploma as an example, is very important to getting into the Indiana University and Purdue University. And so there's strong encouragement. There's ways in which the state grant program and scholars awards interact with price setting. Purdue tells me they lost a lot of money when they jumped up their aid because there's a last dollar feature of the 21st Century Scholars Program, and so they lost a lot of scholars' dollars. it's kind of interesting. There's kind of funny for incentives and all these things, and I think coordinating the incentives is very, very important as institutions try to keep up with the University of North Carolina on the covenant. There's issues around where they go and their attainment, and I'll speak to some of this work. I'm talking fast. How much time do we have?
For you, don't worry about it.
The program, eighth graders make a pledge that they will prepare and they'll get a grant equaling tuition. That's what the state promises, but the state also provides support services, which I'll get into in a bit. Now, we've done a series of studies. We did a couple with the 1999 cohort, an enrollment study, including college choice, and a four-year attainment study. We're finishing a six-year attainment study. And we're now tasked through the Lumina Foundation in the state to look at the 2000 and 2004 and 5 cohorts, actually. And we have different data in each case, so we can look at different things. In the 1999 cohort, we had an eighth grade survey for all eighth graders. In the 2000 data, we had the College Board for the 60% of high school students that took the SAT, which have a detailed questionnaire with courses and so forth. For the 2004 and 5, we have detailed records on all of the engagement activities of scholars and their parents. So the prior studies, we find this positive association between the money and enrollment, and we found positive associations between enrollment in all types of institutions, especially strong odds ratios in the private colleges and the two-year colleges. We think for different reasons. We think for the two-year colleges because they got some people up to the margin of going, and we think in the private colleges because they took advantage of the huge financial resources brought by these students. And it did not function as last dollar in those campuses, given the differences between public and private college grants. So they could put a small grant on top and do well. Now, I think in the earlier study, the fact that we were finding that the scholars were persisting as well as other aided students, and other aided students and scholars persisted better than other students was probably a good thing, but it didn't get communicated quite that well. However, it was communicated in the illuminations picked up by the Chronicle and so forth. There was enough kind of churning around in the foundation, the second thoughts, that fortunately we got the current study funded, you know. So that's how policy works. Troubling financially sometimes leads to more work. Okay, I'll try to be really brief on this, but we're doing a number of analyses that compare scholars and other Pell recipients from among those who go to college. And those who go to four-year colleges and different things. But we're finding an association between being a scholar and getting an advanced curriculum, and especially the honors curriculum, and as I get into it, especially high levels of math like Algebra 2 and Calculus. OK, compared to lower levels of math and so forth. Now, the other thing we're finding is that students, low-income students who go to mostly or predominantly or highly low-income schools are also more likely to get the advanced curriculum. So we're finding that the incentives to schools to offer the curriculum and get more money to get prepared students out is doing something in low-income schools. This is different than the theory that you got to migrate to a middle-class district. So school policy does relate, you know, in a way that we need to. I know, Jay, you've kind of worked with this issue some, and that you, if you, since you've been on the ground in school reform, you know it's real tough work. But it's work that universities need to kind of think through. In the so more on the 2000 cohort. I'm going to skip cohort. I'll skip through this. I want to. This all links up to the school policies issue in the Indiana case, and we don't know yet in the Indiana case whether requiring the curriculum will help or not. It might. It should in the average case, but in the marginal case, there might be some more dropout and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of complexities. We need to monitor the effects of policy in terms of what happens in states. But there's we have a qualitative study going on at the same time now. We find a real kind of a resiliency and attitude change that happens with the scholars, and at least those that stay engaged in activities, which is very important. And one thing that I don't have on the slides, oh, I do. This is very important work, I think. What we've done is we've had all these activity indicators of everything that the student and the parent does, did factor analyses based on counts and different things, and we came up with four factors. The fourth isn't up here because we had these three in both years, but there was a pattern of students who got engaged in counseling services. But there's also a pattern of parent engagement in events, especially campus visits. These two factors really came out as important across the board. We also found that regional centers were important in a number of respects. Anyway, these are the three factors: the counseling, the parent engagement, including but we're finding this link between the counseling and enrollment in two-year colleges. So there's students who are at the margin of getting help that are getting through a certain threshold, and a strong link between the parent engagement, these activities including campus visits that are associated with getting into four-year colleges, including research universities. So we look at it broken down in that way. So I think that for low-income students, given the inequalities in schools and so forth, that these high school policies are very important and important to think about, and thinking about their implementation and whether this is support structure. I think that in that kind of context, the aid guarantees can make a difference. And I think the Indiana studies illustrate this, although I will say that the numbers of students coming in through the scholars program is not the number that's turning Indiana around. The school reforms and the incentive created to fully fund student aid has made a difference. In other words, if essentially, you know, we have both parties in the legislature and so on and so forth, if they're going to give one group kind of a fully funded grant, they give it to everybody who has need. And that has worked very well as an incentive within the state. Now, I want to just conclude trying to pull this together a little bit with implications for the covenant before we have some conversation, and maybe I can get my a little bit of grace so we can have some conversations. So, okay. There's a link between high school reform and access, and that's one of the educational issues I think we need to bring into play as we think about finance reform. And we're being told to do that by the National Governors Association. We're being told to do that by the Spellings Commission. King, are you going to talk about that later?
Yeah, you just
stepped up. Oh, sorry. But we have not evaluated these reforms. Some are working well and some aren't. And so the fact is, the failure to evaluate is part of why we've had this period of growing inequality. We have to bring evaluation into a reflective practice of policy. That means that we tinker with or change or throw out bad policy. We just haven't done that in K-12 policy. Instead, we have assumed for 25 years that accountability and standards is the answer, when in fact it seems to be other things in the reforms. Just finance, this public criticism, I think, is really hard to overcome. Bringing people together is very tough, and I don't have any answers for this. I think that Wisconsin need-based aid, really critical, because how do you give money to one group and not have a fairer system of aid? Big issue. You got to remember that in Indiana, these things kind of went hand in hand, and there's a cost of the failure to invest in aid. I think that it's really important, if you give a guarantee, to fulfill it. Because otherwise, we already know we're educating more students in high school and we're leaving more kids behind. We're creating false promise. And we know that because your numbers, Wisconsin's even doing a little better on that, leaving kids behind, because you got the graduation rates. Well, your college enrollment rate went up just a little bit. So, these are issues we need to kind of think through. And so funding the guarantees, coordinating the guarantees with encouragement services is critical, as I was getting into with our current work with respect to the factors on engagement. This alignment of school reform and admission policies, I think, is really important. And this is the work out of Stanford and so forth. And I've changed my thinking since I've seen that work and look more closely at Indiana and other states. The coordinating state funding and need-based grants with tuition in ways that make sense. Thinking about what the maximum award is, how it's set. Probably not making state grants last dollar in those contexts unless you have total cost of attendance as the maximum award. And recognize this link between funding for higher education and tuition charges as we try to create a revenue situation in colleges that leads to quality higher education. And the revenue can come from tuition if you have aid, and you can have fairness. So anyway, with that, let me stop and I'll field a few questions.
Or another very interesting presentation. I doubt there are any questions, but we'll see.
Can you be more explicit in saying what you mean by we're leaving people behind?
Okay, we're graduating students at a higher rate. Kids are going to college at a lower rate.
Right.
We're in most states, they're taking more advanced curriculum and graduating higher rates, and their test scores are going up. So we know that there are more prepared kids, between 2000 and 2004 at least, who are graduating high school, meeting higher requirements. More of them are taking the test. So not only are the test scores going up, but the rate of taking the test is going up.
But why?
Why are we leaving behind?
No. Why are fewer going on, even though they're better prepared?
I think it's because of the rise in tuition, the middle class federal aid, because we're seeing tremendous variability across the states. New York is way the heck up there.
Yeah. But what research?
So need-based aid and number of seats matters. Yeah. And in fact, there is a correlation between high tuition and college enrollment rates because of the shift that's going on in who pays. But so high tuition is not a problem if you have grants.
But have you gone out to try to find out from these people why they're not going?
Yes.
And what do you
different
find?
People are? Well, I think the research is pardon?
Are they saying high tuition, et cetera? Or maybe they want to get married, they want to go to work, they want to become an apprentice, et cetera.
Yeah, in one of my doctoral student studies in Georgia, in a high school, a very intensive ethnographic study, he found that there was two factors in the school really at play. One was that there was a great deal of knowledge of the HOPE program, and there was in their talk some relationship between that and amongst the kids that dropped out and so forth. There's also another kind of factor in that particular high school, which was the tracking system that was in place. And so I think that case study is just one of many examples of qualitative work. Another is Tierney's work out in California and so forth, and the work that we're doing in Purdue is doing in Indiana right now. But so the qualitative data shows what you would expect. It's a complicated environment in the lives of students. And in fact, the way that the language gets constructed in the family is not always about costs. It's looking at options to make enough money. So they may be talking about dropping out and going to proprietary schools, but if they've been encouraged along the way, they're talking by their senior year about going to a four-year college. So very same student. So it turns out that these contexts do matter, and there's a reproductive cycle in a low-income family without intervention that will reproduce. And we know that from cultural capital research. We have to intervene in ways that change that cycle. Money is only one part of it. It's not the only thing. Yep. School reform, encouragement. Yep. And even then, you leave a lot of kids behind.
Other questions?
Ed, I think as you recommend to these states these programs, you got to be real careful and explicit on the details, because the devil is in the details of these in the formulas. The New York program, the TAP program, has about 52% of all the funding that goes into that program flows to 26% of the student population from wealthier backgrounds.
That's because of the tuition equalization grant in New York is a college choice grant.
Right.
And so there's two grant mechanisms in New York. So they do bring things into play in terms of the reporting of need-based grants. And there are many states that have, so the devil is in detail, there are many states that have merit features in the need-based grants. As an example, Indiana gives more money to kids with an honors diploma than it would give to a child with a regular diploma. So these programs are not pure need-based, they're politically crafted.
Right.
And so this is a good point, and I'm happy to respond to any question about
I mean, when you look nationally, what you end up seeing with the state need-based grants under the umbrella of need-based, it's, as you just pointed out, it's not as need-based as most people think.
Yeah, there's a lot of hybrid programs that are politically crafted.
It ends up being choice-based and cost of attendance-based, which far more than Pell Grants and far more than many of the federal programs, some federal programs have that provision. So it does have the tendency to be cost-sensitive or sticker price-sensitive.
Yeah, but
and the difference, I'll get the good difference is the Cal Grant A versus Cal Grant B. We fight hard to increase Cal Grant Bs because it's an income-based grant to our students. The Cal Grant
A, the ones that couple with A through Gs.
The Cal Grant A gives a $9,500 grant for a student who picks Stanford.
Yeah.
From a wealthier family.
Well, there's the public, but keep in mind the statistics, you know, on returns. There's a wonderful return to a state of a student graduating from Stanford, just as there is from, is it Whitmore in Santa Barbara?
Yeah.
Or, you know, in other words.
Well, I agree. I just want to.
And that's still a cheaper dollar than going to UC. I mean, cheaper to the state.
Well, so, not CSU now.
Because of the subsidy that's cut to CSU plus the grant
equals about $9,000.
Okay, so it's about the same.
Right. So
okay, so
the danger,
you're an advocate of public colleges, my friend.
The danger,
and I love you for it, you know, and it's a good thing.
Ed, the danger, my only comment is the danger is that when we take choice beyond access.
Okay, and that's the problem with Pell. As we came to middle income, we created a great middle income choice program. So you're absolutely right. And how we deal with the minimum, see what happened in the Middle Income Student Assistance Act is we moved from income-based criteria to pure need. And so, and you're right on the Cal Grant A and B. It's always been a problem in California. California did have a bill in play to do something like the 21st Century Scholars. I didn't hear if it passed. I knew it was in committee and so forth. But these are political issues in states. And you're right. Within each state, the devil is in the details and it's extraordinarily political. And I'm glad you're there fighting the battle. I wasn't. I was just pointing out that, okay.
All right. Just a general question. But okay. What would it take to make evaluation politically correct so we'd get more of it? You know, so you have this, like you're saying that.
Well, you know, I think that we need. This is like, how do you pick up $481,000? Because it's a big question. I think that, and the response of citizens expecting is very important. I think that you and Lee talked about the pendulum. Fogel's book, did you read The Fourth Awakening? You read it. Okay. There's a lot of theory out there. Who the heck knows? But I think that the public needs to have an awareness of the problem. I think that we've been, I think that the shift that took, Theodore Bell was a wonderful man, but he may have sold his soul to save the Department of Education, and we may be paying the price. And he's a good Mormon, and I'm a very religious person myself, and so I think in the name of the good, we often do things that we think are good, that we need to think about. And what came into play, the concept of leadership that emerged in the U.S. Department of Education was kind of ignorant leadership, which is to say that it was based on correlations, and just because something correlates, it doesn't mean requiring it makes it happen. And so we've had an extraordinarily naive policy for 25 years that has been the most, one of the more cruel periods of our history with respect to, we moved from one of our most equitable periods of history to back to almost like a, it's not that bad. I mean, there is some water rising for all, but the inequalities are severe, you know? And so I think that we need an attitude change, and we need to hold states accountable, and we can't just believe the rhetoric of reform. We have to look beyond the rhetoric of reform. So I don't know if that helps, but I think you raised a good question.
Other questions or comments?
Go ahead, Nick.
What federal levers were there that were not pulled?
Well, I think that the big mistake was that there was, what happened is the following. And I'm going to put it in, if you go back to your, I think 83 piece and so forth. Your piece was probably the last thing taken seriously that an economist did in D.C.
Revelation to us.
Well, I mean, in other words, it was kind of a questioning of Pell, you know. But since then, there really hasn't been, and that's maybe that climate might be starting to change again, fortunately, because the National Bureau of Economic Research has finally tackled education. But what happened was that Reagan tried to get self-help, he lost. He shifted to the loan strategy. And that was never evaluated. And in fact, as the bad numbers came back, they started writing reports and with about the correlation with math. I was at Pelevin Associates when they got tasked to do the minority education report. And all the analyses I did on student aid got pushed out of the report, and we just reported the Algebra 1 finding. And so I published that when I left the firm, you know, and it was more complex than that. At that point, we knew it was encouragement, preparation of student aid, but we couldn't put it in those reports. So the reports have not been evaluations, they've been political instruments. And in fact, I think we've moved to a point where our National Center for Education Statistics is pushing down of kind of political appointments and mentalities gotten where we have no neutral research anymore. And I think that is seriously jeopardizing the quality of education in the country. If you think about it, we were number one when the Nation at Risk came out. In college going, where are we now, about 15th? That's your best indication of the failure of the reform model. It's a great indicator. I hope you say that. I hope you repeat that. You don't even have to attribute it to me.
No, the numbers are pretty stark.
You know, so you got NGA and all these groups, oh, we're so bad. But they fail to recognize that 25 years of reform has failed us. How could you write a report that's so ignorant? It's 2 + 2. It's supposed to equal 4. They aren't even doing basic math. I mean, really, because we're just talking simple math. I think the data is there. I think it's abundantly evident, and I think it's been an attitude. It's kind of an elitist academic attitude that assumes more education is better, and the kids that don't have it, it's their own fault. Go ahead, Lee.
So, did the rise of the Department of Education give rise to a change in attitude at the states, so they felt less responsible?
Because the neocons and neoliberals took over everywhere, and they didn't disagree on education policy. Clinton's policy did not differ from Bush 1 or Reagan's policy. We have not had a policy change in this country for 25 years. Clinton headed Bush 1's gubernatorial goof board. Whatever it was. I mean, the goof-off board of governors. So, I'm sorry to be so strong. But people have failed to think about this. And I think it's a serious problem. I know that you'll say this better because you're a president. Cliff knew I'm a wild man, so I had to act for him.
I hate to take us in a different direction because that's really fascinating, but I do want to point, get a little clarification. Ed, did you say that University of Michigan uses tuition to finance financial aid? And if they do, or in general, can you talk about the pros and cons of doing that,
yeah,
walking away from maybe the, even further from the federal and state commitments?
Yeah, we call, we have a pretty unique constitutional autonomy. So we have room that even Michigan State doesn't have. We work on an incentive-based budgeting model that is much like a lot of the Big Tens. There's an allocation of a number following students. So while the university is trying to have donor dollars fill that need gap, there has been, as we adjusted to Prop 2 and other things, and we're able, you know, it turns out that the shift from affirmative action is extremely expensive. Because you can yield diversity with adjusting emissions, but to do it fairly and equally, we have to pour extraordinary amounts of money in, because there's a lot of poor people who are qualified. So, and it's irresponsible in a state to implement this kind of policy where you have one group that's largely income, low income, without having a policy that equalizes opportunity for low income. And so in Michigan, the university is using some of its general fund and tuition dollar. It's not very well known. Being on the faculty budget committee for the university, I see it and can decode. And decoding is very important, and I probably shouldn't speak in public about that. And I know this is very public, so I apologize. But decoding budgets is complicated, but you've got to have a big picture in mind because you get lost in the detail. As you know.
Further questions or comments from wild men or women or others?
I'll just add to that a tad, and that is Michigan has high tuition model and high aid, much higher in both than Wisconsin.
Well, our high aid's pretty recent, and in fact, we've dropped from number one in the Big Ten to about 34th in our public tuition. So we're managing, you know, we're at about 11% now on general fund revenue in general. ENG per student's over $100,000. Now, most of that's research money, and we generate some of our money off of research. So the research base in Michigan can't be set aside when we talk about these issues, because you generate money for the units based on it. They're making up more than whatever tuition rate there is on their research dollars. So, you know, budgets are complex, and if you wanted to say in a net dollar sense, we could probably show a revenue stream that would show that we weren't using that money. It's the flow of funds model in terms of internal budget incentives would show that that's happening, but we could yield a spreadsheet to show that that wasn't happening.
But what's your ENG taking out research?
It varies. We follow the overhead rate in research?
No.
Okay, when it's taken out, we're closer to 25. Which is probably where you are, 25 to 30? State?
No. Well, I am not sure.
We also have pretty healthy out-of-state enrollment, which helps 20. Us. 20. Yeah, we may be a little higher then. Because, I mean, who knows? I don't know how we met. You know, we have, I guess we don't wear shoestrings. I have on sandals today. And so we're less than we're not wearing shoestrings. I don't know. You know, I think that, and we're also, we've just finished a $2 billion campaign. So it's an extraordinarily interesting place. Very different than Indiana, I'll say that.
I think you touched on it a little bit, but are there other metrics that influence the way the states are reacting, like cost per FTE or other operational things?
Well, you know, there are. In our state, there was a report put out by the Mackinac Institute by a fellow down at Ohio U. I don't know if you've seen that report.
Better?
Yeah, fair. Man, it's been taken real seriously, you know. And the fact is, I mean, he doesn't put in time as a variable, as a model, and all kinds of things. I mean, I don't, you know, I just get, the fighting over econometrics to me is kind of not fun. I'm not an economist. You might like it. But, so certain reports are taken seriously when they come out and are promoted to a legislature and they reinforce certain viewpoints. And so, you know, basically this report's the total opposite. It's saying there's no return to the state. You know, I mean, basically, it's sort of saying it's a losing proposition. So we ought to release your report. I'll get our president's commission to release your paper in the state, you know, if you want.
I would be willing. I put my work through the referee process and bet on it much more.
Well, you know, we ought to bring you in and debate because these things are very important. I mean, it's not that anybody's method. You explain the conservative assumption that you're making. I did an exercise like this once a long time ago for a return on student aid dollars. You know, and you have to make conservative assumptions. Otherwise, you're going to get shot out of the water. But so you have put together a very carefully crafted paper, and it's a sensible ratio. Lee's comment is correct, because we've been having a policy. So what Federer's work shows is you move away from funding, you still have returns. It's a good deal to state. But so where do we? How do we bring fairness into all this? You know, and I've been really struggling to A, find simple ratios, and B, to explain them, because if you find them, they're hard to explain. The Minnesota model was hard to explain while it worked, and so forth.
Along those lines, I think it's along those lines. It's important to know that the difference between real costs and expenditures, and the battle we have been trying to get everybody to expose their expenditures. The per student expenditures over the last 25 years, and you wouldn't believe the resistance by many institutions in Washington to kill this, to not talk about it, because it tells an interesting story. And the Lumina Foundation right now, Jane Wellman and others, are collecting this data, and it tells an interesting story: who's serving more, who's doing it more efficiently, who's keeping down their pricing and their costs. And this is an important battlefield that will eventually be exposed, but there's a lot of blood on the ground.
Yeah.
In the last
well, and
years.
In fact, that area of work that's gone on in the congressional cost studies and so forth over time, I think, is very important work. You know, overall, we do see some increase in the ed-related expenditures, but we also see segments of institutions that are pretty economical and low-priced, community colleges being the best example. But certain groups of comprehensive colleges have become good bargains for states. And that's the argument I think you were making. It's very, you know, so in a state like California, you can, you know, if you constrain the UCs, they become very elite, but there's so many of them and they're so good, you know, so you really have a variable difference in.
Expenditures grow, they grow, but not like the other expenditures going on around the country in many other states.
Yeah, and much at a much slower rate than tuition.
Right.
And so people think that colleges are realizing the revenue dollar from the tuition increases, and they're not. Often when there's a big increase, they actually have a net revenue loss that year because of the way the two revenue sources work together. It's kind of the good year of the 5% that you make the gain. So these things are really important, and they're poorly understood, and people want quality education, but they don't want the state to pay for it, I guess is the problem.
Students know that they can get money for college by serving in the National Guard, reserves, or entering the military and returning and getting funds. I'm wondering if you've teased out the influence of this poverty draft, in effect, upon what is being offered to low-income students in terms of financial aid.
You know, it's been mostly in the qualitative studies I've mentioned. We don't have a simple way to bring it into our models because the funding comes into play much later. And in fact, the people who have done the modeling for the military say fairly openly, you know, behind closed doors at least, that what they did on a lot of the benefits was realize that the take rate is up rate is so low that they can afford to offer high benefits and not have it cost the military much. So yes, there's a promise. It's kind of like the, and it is fulfilled, but you're discouraged from taking it. That's been in the press some. So the educating soldiers of their educational rights is crucial, and somebody should take that on.
Other questions from Cliff or anyone else in the audience?
Cliff, you got to have a question.
Didn't mean to put Cliff on the spot.
All right, it's good. It's good to be among friends. You know, this is a.
Okay, we'll take a break. Thank you very much, Ed St. John. Thank you. And please return at 1 o'clock where Dr. David Wirtz will enlighten us. Thank you.